Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planting leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
Hey, we're going to get started. We got four guys up here. This is the mistake-driven church. We have PhDs
and we've made plenty
in mistakes.
Of them.
Yep. And so we want to share those with you. I'll introduce the panel in just a sec when Ron gets up here. But we just find that, I don't know about you, but you come to conferences and you hear different, you know, success stories, and it just sounds like everything just going great. And the reality is there's a lot of mistakes behind any church, and we've made a lot of them. This is Ron. Ron, just tell him like 1 minute, which is like impossible for pastors, but just 1 minute about your story, where you're at, what you're doing, then we'll just go down the line here.
My name is Ron Sylvia, pastor of Church at the Springs in Ocala, Florida, the other side of the world. And we started, my wife and I started it in 1994, so we've been 19 years in, and you'll hear plenty of them. But we did everything wrong that you could do wrong, and we are living proof that you can make it through it. So,
the God of the second chance, right?
And the third and the fourth.
And we started, actually started three churches and, over a period of 22 years, two in Southern California, one in Northern California. And now I'm director of church planning with the EFCA West. But after starting one and being there 8 years, it was like, oh boy, I get to do another one and learn from all those mistakes. So did the second one, and we were there for 10 years, and then a year and a half, the third one, and then I came into this position. So I got to make mistakes at three different churches.
My name is Mark Lee. We planted a church called Vantage Point Church about 40 miles just immediately north of here and close to an area called Corona, California. So for me, I mean, oh my gosh, it's like a dream come true. I'm only 5 years away from our launch, and I just still remember sitting where you guys are sitting going, number one, I don't know if I should be planting a church. Then the next stage was, I'm going to be planting a church, but who on earth would even want to come to my church? And so 5 years later, to even be sitting here sharing mistakes that we've made and maybe even things that we've done right, it's like a dream come true for me. So thanks for letting me be up here.
I'm Brett Andrews, New Life Christian Church in Northern Virginia. We started about 20 years ago, church planting church. We've planned several churches. We run Exponential out of our offices. Todd Wilson's on staff with us. Dan Smith was on staff with us. We planted Dan's church and several others, and so it's good to be here.
Yeah, so what we'd like to do, we're going to share some mistakes. I'm going to actually ask these guys, what is like the biggest mistake you've made so far, would you say? Think about that just for a minute. And then we're going to share kind of a top 10 mistakes. And depending on who you talk to, you know, I looked at a lot of stuff. I mean, I came up with my own list, and we've talked a lot. Ron and I have talked a lot. We've done this before. Ed Stetzer has the 10 biggest mistakes. Perry Noble has his list. So many people have their list. We'll kind of share a list of 10, but then we'd love to open it up to you guys and just to have you guys just ask questions and kind of banter back and forth. And we want this to be really helpful for you guys and kind of scratch where you itch. So let's start with Ron. Ron, what would you say is the biggest mistake you've made as a church planter?
Well, I think for certain on the area of leadership, we chose our leadership too quickly. We had, you start a church and you're like, man, I don't even know any of these people. We're starting, and if you know who Jesus is, you're an elder, right? And, I mean, the qualifications were really low. And so when we start, I got this vision, and I just pulled together a group of guys that, hey, you're believers. This will work great. Listen, you've been a Christian for 5 years. You know, you're chairman of the elders. And so I surrounded myself with all these guys, and they loved Jesus. They just didn't know what the vision of the church was. And so it became sideways energy really fast. Uh-huh. And so for me, you know, and again, you're starting, and we probably had about 75 people at that point, 100 people, and I was going, okay, these guys don't even know what the vision of the church is. They're not following. We're in trouble. We're all leaders. And I remember praying, going, God, what do I do? And he said, and this is the word I got back, disband the leadership team.
Good decision.
And I was like, how? I mean, how do you disband the leadership team? And then it was just that whisper of God, I will. And I just stopped calling meetings. And they all left. Within 30 days, they all left. I looked up one day, they were gone. I said, good job. You know, but
they had all left the church.
They all left the church. And the other interesting thing is to this day, nobody ever asked where they went, which tells you that they really weren't leaders.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but for, you know, for me, that was huge because I just chose too quickly and, you know, and God had different plans. So,
yeah, and that's actually on the top 10 mistakes we're going to give you. That's the number one mistake that we found. Ron just told you about it, but forming a leadership team too quickly. And I did the same thing in terms of the first church we started. You know, we're scrambling. It's happening so fast. You got these new believers. A month into it, we baptized 14 people. We kept seeing these new people. And we tried to do one-on-one discipleship, me and my wife, but it just, the supply was greater. Yeah, or the demand was greater than the supply. And so we started just grabbing people, say, would you help disciple? Would you help disciple? And we'd find people, you sometimes have guys who were ministers in other churches, and now they're teaching or selling insurance. And I thought erroneously that it was like my job to get them back into ministry, you know, and, oh, you start doing this. And so I did the same thing. Like 6 months in, I formed a leadership team. And it was me and three other guys, and two of those other guys were ordained guys, former ministers who were like selling insurance. And it was a nightmare. And we encouraged to do name tags when you first start the church. It's a great way for people to get to know one another. And so I wanted to purchase name tags, not to just slap on the ones, but some nice name tags. And they thought we shouldn't. That they thought that was not a good thing to use our budget on. And so we voted, and I lost. And so I told Rick Warren about it. Rick was mentoring me. We were daughters of Saddleback Church. And he said, Dave, disband that group immediately. And so I went back, and I said, my coach has said to disband you guys. And same thing. Well, three out of the four left.
He told me to.
They said, we have no confidence in your leadership. And so three out of the four left. The one guy stayed. Then I waited another 6 months. And then I formed a pastoral advisory team. That's what we encourage, because then you can get advice, but you have the final decision. And you get to know people over time. And then eventually you form your team. You know, you select elders. You have your pastoral management team, whatever you call it. But take your time. Probably number one mistake that people made. I made that one, but I think the biggest mistake I made was hiring from a leadership, hiring competency over character, and had a flashy, you know, people came out of the secular world who'd become Christians. They weren't Christians that long. They were in the music industry in L.A., and I brought them on and started discipling them, trained them. Tremendous singer, tremendous musician. It was a husband and wife, great guitar player, singer, worked with the musicians and the singers. And they did great songs and worship, but there were character issues, which came to bite us years later. And so I learned really, really a lot from that experience, that no matter how good they are, no matter how flashy they are, exciting, charismatic, the key is they've got to have the character. They've got to be authentic. They've got to be honest. They've got to be teachable. And if you don't see that going into it, stop right there. It's so much better. It's harder to get them out once they're in. So always look for that. It's not a given. You want to look for that. Mark?
I think for me, one of the top mistakes that I made was not dealing with issues before they became crises. It's so easy, whether it be with a staff person, in particular a staff person, for you to think maybe you've got the right volunteer leader or volunteer staff person, or think that you've got the perfect paid staff person, and you almost want to abdicate that position to somebody else, because there's almost this what Steve Shogren calls this Jesus-Judas complex. You know, that in the beginning you have this huge itch for someone to fill that role, and so they're the savior of your world, and you think, go, take it off my plate, run with it so that I never have to think about it again. But pretty soon they begin to take that in a direction that you begin to not like, and you don't address some of the things that are going on, and you're not in the trenches with that. I mean, not like you don't have to be doing everything with them, but you're not kind of retweaking the vision as you go or addressing some of these really small issues as you go along. You play passive aggressive. The person becomes Judas, and you can't wait to get them out of your life at that point. Like, I think one of the things that I've gotten better at as a leader, and in particular being married for 15 years, I think one of the things that I've gotten better at as a communicator is to actually communicate better while I'm off stage. And with my own staff people or with volunteer leaders, not only character issues, but to say, not we all think that calling somebody to the carpet is this power, this mean move. But I think I've talked to so many staff people who have been so hurt by churches because the churches were so nice to them up until the day they fired them. Mm-hmm. Never gave them notice, never told them anything that they were doing wrong, never ever corrected them or tried to retweak them along the way, and then all of a sudden they got the axe. I mean, I don't think that's an employee problem. I think that's a leadership problem. And so one of the things that I try and do, even I have to have a talk with somebody relatively soon just to say, hey, you're pretty new, but even before we get to your three-month review, like, how do you think things are going? And, hey, this is what I've kind of seen, and you tell me if you think this. I think some balls have been dropping recently, and I think things are getting done a little bit slower than I would like. Like, can we just talk about that? Like, I'm not leveling any accusations. I'm not blaming anybody for anything. I'm just kind of saying, hey, let's begin a conversation. But a lot of times, I think in particular, if you're, I think if you're introverted, what may happen too is that you want to process everything in your head outside of the other person. You and God have come to a decision. You come off of your holy mount, and then all of a sudden, you know, the decision has been unveiled. Well, I think even with potential leaders and current leaders, it's good to have adjustments and tweaks and alignments and conversations, because very rarely will you ever find the perfect person who is the perfect match, who agrees with you in every. You're going to have to address things even like, hey, I've been noticing that you've been leaving the office a little bit early. Like, can we talk about that? Is that a big issue? Like, and it seems so stupid and so minute, but the problem is, my blood is starting to boil over somebody coming in 30 minutes late and, you know, taking really long lunch hours and leaving early. And so I'm not saying that has to bother you, and I'm not saying that you can't set an office culture that's different. All I'm saying is this. Before my blood gets to a boiling point, I feel the need now more so than before to go, hey, let's have this safety valve where the two of us can I'm going to compromise too. I'm going to compromise in that dialogue. We're going to come to a good middle ground 90% of the time. But can we just get to a middle ground? Sorry, Brett.
So Mark, so that's the great mistake you made would be that you kind of did that. You put it off. Yes. And you didn't nip it in the bud kind of. Now you're trying to address it as you see things. And one thing Mark said,
As
they're there. One thing Mark said was, you know, he doesn't just lower the boom, and he doesn't use statements like you did this, you did that, as much as I observe, I saw this. And that's something we teach in the coaching network, isn't it, Ron? We observe this, no accusations, but this is just what I've observed, and give them a chance then to talk about it, and that all opens a dialogue. So,
number one, I think your organization and my organization, our churches, God's church, is so important that we come into it with such passion that I think bad apples need to be addressed.
Yeah.
But here's another thing too. This is how I've defined servant leadership in my own mind, and I don't know if this is even really true. When I come into the room and when I talk to somebody, like we typically think a boss talks to an employee, then sometimes I have a tendency to think maybe I'm using my power. But in my own mind, the way I've come to the idea of servant leadership is this. Have I tried to talk to my employee the way that I would talk to my spouse? Because I don't walk into a room and tell my spouse, you know what, you better get your act together. I walk into a room and say, hey, honey, like, I've just noticed these things, and in my mind and for me, there's a certain gentleness, I think, that I've approached servant leadership with, and I don't know if that's true or if that's not.
All right, Brett.
I'm not smart enough to be able to think through which is the biggest mistake, whatever. If I can evade the question for a second, here's what one thing I would say is that that comes out of all three of the comments that you've just made. I think one of the hardest things about leadership in the church is just the ability to think critically and with wisdom. It's easy to look at all of the mistakes that you made and to just say, okay, I'm not going to make that mistake, and then you end up making the opposite mistake. All of those decisions that you made were made for good reasons. I think it was G.K. Chesterton that said, the same roads that lead into Jerusalem lead out of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Why is it that you had leadership too soon? It's because you wanted accountability. It's because you believe that there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors.
True.
And there's a humility to that. The opposite side of that is to say, well, then I'm not going to get leaders, and you go to the opposite, right? Why is it that you are delegating and wanting to entrust? That's a really good thing. You know, but at the same time, when we hired our executive minister, the first question that he asked me in the interview was, do you run toward conflict or do you run away from conflict? You know, and being able to think through, not everything is, you know, it's the whole, is it cancer or is it a cold? You have to be able to discern. If it's a cold, you let it go. It'll take care of itself. If you treat it like cancer, you're going to create a bigger problem.
Yeah.
But if it's cancer and you don't address it, it's going to kill you. So it's that... God, give me the – I think the hardest thing in church leadership is, God, give me the wisdom to know, because sometimes, candidly, you do need to come in if somebody's acting like a 12-year-old, and you do have to be parental and say, these are the values. This is who we are, and you need to live up to that. Other times, you do need to have more of the adult approach. The one thing, if I could state that in a mistakes that I've made statement – I think the good thing is to always assume best motives of people. One of the mistakes that I've made is assuming a selfish motive, an immaturity, whatever. And often it's somebody who's well-motivated but needs clarity, or I haven't been clear enough with direction or priorities or values.
Good stuff, Brett. And just that balance he talked about, so one, we went on the extreme, but the other extreme can be just as big a mistake. So being able to balance that. Let me throw out some other ones, Brett, Mark, Ron, and you guys just kind of comment as you want to on these. But after forming a leadership team too quickly, second one was not taking care of yourself and your family. That is something I know I made the mistake. We talk about launching large, and when you launch large, there's a lot of time, effort, money put in on the front end. So I remember working those, you know, 14, 15-hour days getting ready for the launch large. And the way it manifests itself in me, I would get sick a lot. I hardly ever get sick now. But when I was planning churches, leading up to the launch, I'd get sick. One time, second church, I got laryngitis a week before the grand opening.
Oh.
And I honestly could not talk. And I'm just thinking, God, what's going on here? What are you doing to me? And it's like, okay. And it came back like 2 or 3 days before that Sunday. And I don't know what he was doing, but I found I got sick a lot. And so I started not only taking care of myself. Mark's a great advocate in this in terms of runner. He's a runner. He's run marathons. I think it's really important you take care of yourself from a physical standpoint. I work out a lot. I do running, cardio weights, that kind of thing. it just it's not only good for the stress, but just really, really taking care of yourself. And then I just found out from a germ standpoint, I've become like a germophobic kind of guy now.
Why you won't shake my hand?
I do shake your hand. I just do the bump. I do the Howie Mandel bump. But if you figure, figure like Ron, pastor's church, 3,000 people. Ron's hugging, patting people on the back, shaking hands, kissing the ladies. Kissing the babies, I'm sorry. And so, you know, there's so many germs. So I had this pastor friend, he said, right after the service, I was with him one Sunday, and we went in the restroom, and he washed his hands. I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm washing off the fellowship. And so after every service, washing your hands, just taking care of yourself from that point. But guys, kind of chime in on this one, not taking care of yourself or your family.
Can I shift gears? Yeah, dude, because you did a great job with that. But I'm, I want to make sure we cover some ground. The huge mistake for me is I was in student ministry, and I watched as a student pastor. How many of you are former student ministers? Okay. Then, you know, I sat there, and, you know, you're watching, and you're doing student ministry, and I watched our pastor in the church I was in cater to the money people. And as a matter of fact, you know, I remember I was told we were doing a student concert, and they said we're going to save the front row seats for this doctor and his staff, and they're not going to get there till 5 minutes before the concert. And I went, what? So the rich man gets a better seat in this church? And yeah, I was on staff for like 3 weeks. That was a bad thing to say. but that pendulum swung for me, and I said, you know what? I won't do that. And so when we started the Springs, I said, you know what? We're not catering to the money people. I don't want to know what people give because I don't want it to taint the way I do ministry. You know, I just want to love everybody. And I'm, you know, and so I stayed away from, I didn't know what people gave. I didn't talk about money because you always heard, well, people don't want to, you know, they don't go to church because all you talk about is money. So don't talk about money. Money for me was one of the biggest mistakes I made in the first 5 years of the Springs. I didn't talk about it enough. And you know what? That's biblical stewardship. That's discipleship. And we veered away from it, and I didn't know what people gave. And you know what I found out is if you want to know who's really heart deep in your church, look at their giving. Because, we put people in places of leadership early on who later on I found out had never given a penny to the church. And they were leaders calling the shots. And, you know, Jesus is the one who said that's where your heart is. And so that's a real, for me, I know what people give, I want to put people that are heart deep in ministry, in leadership. And so I'd say, you know, those are two big mistakes that cost us for the first 5 years of the Springs. And I hear that wrestle in church planters. I don't want to talk about money and I don't want to know what people give. I think that, you know, for us, we did a great disservice to the Springs because we put the wrong people in leadership. And the other thing about giving, you see trends in giving that typically when people stop giving, they stop giving 3 months before they leave the church. And so, you know, when you see somebody stop giving that's been a, you know, faithful giver and they start going, well, you know what, there's an issue and they're about ready to exit. So we talk about money for a long time, but that was a huge one for us. And, you know, and the other thing I found about money is people say, well, you'll offend the unchurched. Listen, no, you know who you offend? You offend disobedient church people. You want to offend them. And, as an unbeliever, I know I didn't come to Christ till I was 21, and I got involved in the church. I got, you know, somebody needs to pay for this stuff. I understood this as a lost guy, and I wanted to, you know, give to pay for the quarterly or the material I was getting. So it's the disobedient church people that you offend, and that's a good thing. So.
And I made that same mistake. I got up 3 years into our first church plant. I never talked about money for three straight years. And so the church grew, but we didn't have the budget to do the ministry that we should have been doing and add the staff that we should have had at that point. because I didn't. So I actually got up and apologized, and I just I'm really sorry. I've got to apologize to you. God's convicted me of this. I'm going to teach you. I've shortchanged you, no pun intended, but I've really, and started teaching about New Testament giving and saw the blessing that came and saw what happened as a result of that. So I think a lot of times, like Brett was saying, with the pendulum swings the other side. We go into ministries. We start churches because we want to reach unchurched people. It's not about the money. We're interested in them. But we kind of get out of balance and we make the mistake. How about you guys?
Yeah, I never looked at the giving until just recently. And I talked to a big mentor figure of mine, Steve Stroop, who's kind of like the master of all that is church finances in my mind. And I remember him just kind of talking to me point blank, which Steve has a great flair of doing. He was just saying, Mark, you believe that money is the greatest indication spiritually of where somebody's heart is, right? And I said, yeah, I mean, that's in the Bible. He said, why do you not as a pastor want to see what's in somebody else's heart? And Ron is right. You know, money, it's not only about who gives what, but it's about different trends. And so one of the things that I try and do is if I see, if I give a money talk and I see somebody all of a sudden take a tithe challenge, then what I'll do is I will call them and I'll say, it looks like you've responded to the challenge. And so that is absolutely amazing. I want to hear what God is doing in your life. I want to hear the story behind that. And they'll say something like, oh my gosh, yeah, they can't wait to talk about it because it was this huge spiritual success for them in their own mind. They'll go, okay, yeah, my husband and I, we've been fighting it for some time, but finally we felt like the Lord was speaking to us, and you gave us like this money-back guarantee, and so that just put us over the edge, and so we started doing it, and we've already seen God work. So I try and engage people on a spiritual level. If we ever have a big gift come in, then we will write that person a thank you card, and we'll just let them know that we've received their gift even. People want to know that, like, if you send an email to somebody and they don't respond to your email, like, sometimes you'll write back and go, hey, did you get my email? Well, how much more does somebody think that way if they've just given like $10,000 or something like that? Did you even receive it? Did you even get it? And so we'll do something like that. But I'm with Ron. A dip too. If money is really the chief indication of somebody's heart, then if I see a dip in somebody's giving as well in that trend, it could be that they're going to leave the church. And I've made calls before saying, hey, I don't say, hey, I notice a dip in your giving. I say, hey, I noticed that you haven't been around as much. And I just wanted to know, are you mad at me? You're probably mad at me, right? Did I do something to offend you? Or maybe what I'll say, or maybe I use it as a shepherding tool. What's going on in their life? A lot of times, or some of the times, they'll even say, no, we're not mad at you, Mark. We, my husband just lost his job. And so, like, we just have a lot of things going on. Can you pray for us? Different things like that. I don't know if I'm allowed to ask a question. One of the things that I'm struggling with right now is, how and do you guys engage, like, the top-tier givers? I mean, that's a question that I have. I don't know if you guys can address that or what. But Brett, I'll let you go now.
Let's stick on the mistakes for right now and go with Brett. And then.
If I can make a small point that goes to a different, bigger point, in terms of money, I think one of the big mistakes we made was how we've done the offering disclaimer. It was really popular for a while, and maybe it still is, to say, if you're new here, don't give, you know? And we did that offering disclaimer, and what that really communicates is two things. One is you're an outsider, and we don't want you to participate in a sense, which we don't want to create walls. The other thing that communicated unintentionally was your giving doesn't matter. We were communicating to everybody, if you give, it's okay. If you don't give, it's okay. And so we've changed our whole offering disclaimer just to make it biblical and to say, God's, this is an expression of our faith. This is an expression of worship. And the Bible says, don't give under compulsion. So we want everybody to give as an expression of where you are with God. And but if you feel like you're doing this just because you have to, we want our worship to be genuine. So do what's genuine. Do what God's leading you to do. But everyone, this is to, you know, we'll say it in some different way. But I think that was a big mistake, because I think for years we pounded in people subliminally, your giving doesn't matter. The bigger point that I would make from that I think is a huge mistake that we made, is, and it's a discerning mistake, discerning the difference between what's a fad and what's a trend. Because I think that we can latch on to fads and then the viruses that come along with them and end up infecting us. And I'll say small groups, for instance. Small groups, there is a biblical precedent in small groups that is a trend, but there is a utopianism to small groups that I think probably grew out of liberation theology, where their whole idea of spreading liberation theology was through base communities, and these base communities were utopian communities that answer all the questions, that are going to solve all the problems. And one of the things that we bought into for a while for a church is, what, you know what the answer is? Small groups. You know how we solve that? Small groups. Well, we'll fix that in small groups. How are we going to do that? In small groups. And there's like our small groups became the utopian community for the church. And now we've come to the realization, especially where we are, small groups are not the answer to everything for discipleship. They're one answer, but we put way too much weight on it. As a result, we were ineffective in a lot of our discipleship. So, and that's one example of, you have to discern what's the trend, what's a fad. Multi-site. There is a trendiness to multi-site. There's a faddishness to multi-site. What is of multi-site that was used in the first century will last forever. What's of today is not going to endure, and we're going to find that that's just really painful, the stuff that we picked up on. So anyway, so we have to really discern God help me understand here. What's a fad that I should not latch on to, and what's the biblical trend that we need to hold on to?
Yeah, shift gears, another topic, I think for us, big mistake, staff. We waited too long to hire the first staff. I don't know what all the numbers say, but I know for us, we were running 300 people on the weekend before I hired our second staff member. And so I was doing everything and running wide open, and it was my wife, Teddy, and I, we were just everything. We did it. And so we got to that place. We waited too long because we always said the same thing. We can't afford them. I mean, look at the budget. Look at the giving. Well, part of the problem is I didn't talk about money, so we didn't have money. So, and so we had people, but nobody was giving. And so we waited too long. And you find, at least we found out, that a good staff member pays for themselves in the first 6 months. If they don't, you hired the wrong staff member, and then it's time to free their future, as Andy Stanley says, and that's a whole nother conversation. But with staffing issues, the other thing that I've done is we've waited too long to free somebody's future. And somebody that doesn't fit, I've got guys the challenge in a growing church is, as the church grows, you outgrow some of your staff's capacity. They can't go where you're going. And that is the hardest thing about staffing, is because you love people, but you know you're going to kill them if they stay. Yeah. This is beyond their scope. They were great at 300 or 500, but if you start bumping 1,000, they can't do it. They can't. And so you've got to, release them. And everybody else around you, here's the thing about releasing staff. I think you did a whole talk on that in a breakout, but everybody else knows that it's time for them to go. And they're wondering if you have enough leadership chutzpah to take care of it. And, because I mean, every time I've done that, my mistake is I always wait too long. Because I love them. And I want to make it, I want to figure it out. And we try everything. And what I realize is that I just think about one recently in the last year and a half that we walked through this staff member leaving. I had 10 staff members come up to me and thank me. They said, "You have no idea what we've been through in the last 4 years. Every week, thank you." And I'm thinking, you know what? I put that off for 4 years too long. And it's a hard conversation. So that's another one of those staffing issues.
Yeah, and the worst thing you can do is keep somebody on staff who's not a good fit or who's not performing up to where they need to be performing, because they could be somewhere else. They could be a great fit. They could be thriving somewhere else, but they're not there. First guy I hired about a year and a half into it, I let him go. And I never kind of kept him on too long. I maybe did the other wrong, but I learned very early on to hire slowly but fire quickly. Did any of you see the movie Moneyball and with Brad Pitt? And it's about the Oakland A's and Billy Beane. It's a great scene where he teaches them how to fire to let players go, or they've been traded, and he has to go through it. And one of the things we do in the coaching network is we have guys actually fire. How many have ever fired somebody? Raise your hand if you've ever fired somebody. Okay, so it's about the same percentage. About half of the pastors in our networks have never fired anybody, and they don't know how. And what happens if you don't fire them when they need to be fired, it can cripple your church. It can cripple your staff. It can, like Ron was saying, it just hurts morale in the process. Why don't you lead us through some more there, Ron, just kind of diesel through those.
Can I make just one quick comment about staffing? My quick comment is also learn your staff's love language. What I've realized is that staffing is so much like parenting. We all know this, right? You have to parent each child different, and guess what? You also need to boss. This is what I think. I think you need to boss every employee different, because they all have different needs. They all come from different places. And everybody's love language is pay. But beyond pay, I mean, if you're working in the church for pay, you're probably in the wrong place, for one. But this is what I've realized, that different staff members I have underneath me have different needs. Some of them need more input. Some of them need more access. So I got a worship guy, Tom. He could care less if he ever spoke to me for the rest of his life. Just give him equipment and he's happy. You know, some people are very relational. Some people need to be resourced more. I think in order to understand who they are as individuals, that makes you a better supervisor.
Brett, how many staff do you guys have?
I don't know. 20. No. Well, I mean, with when you count patch for planting and exponential and all that stuff, 20-some, I don't know.
Okay. When you think about staffing, any mistakes?
I think you're too hard on yourself, to be honest with you. Yeah. In all seriousness, because your staff is also watching you, and do you mm-hmm. abuse your staff, or are you compassionate to your staff? Yeah. And, yeah, you may have held on to some people a little bit too long, mm-hmm. but the rest of your staff also looks in that and says, they're going to treat me with some grace too. Yeah. And I want to be on a staff with a guy like that. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
yeah.
Yes.
Because the pendulum swing is, we've all seen the guys that go, you're fired and someone's cleaning your desk out while we're talking to you. I need your keys, and that whole corporate thing.
Yeah. And, part of this is the lesson everybody knows. There's not a right way to do things. And perfectionism is a terrible tyrant mm-hmm. to live under. This sense, I live in this constant thing of, I know I'm doing it wrong. I know somebody else would do this better than I. And you just have to say, God, what do you want to do? God, if you want to let this person go, just make it clear, and I will do my best to follow.
Well, when it comes to the launch, let's talk about the launch and the start of a church. For us, I think one of the big mistakes we made is, we didn't know. We didn't have the training. We didn't never heard of church planting before that. We started in stealth mode. I mean, with 21 people in an office complex, we picked the best time of year to launch. It was the week before Thanksgiving. I mean, it's like, really? I mean, there was no strategy. There was no, let's just start. I mean, let's start. And we started with 21 people in the basement of an office complex. We didn't advertise. We didn't tell anybody. Matter of fact, I told people when we first started, I said, y'all, stop bringing people. We're just still trying to figure this out. We did. I did. I told them, don't bring anybody. And disobedient church people that they were, they kept bringing people. But it was just one of those, you know, man, when I think we just did everything wrong in terms of what you hear today. And, man, there's so much good strategy and so many good thoughts. But it was, we met in a room in a basement. And it was a creepy time, really, for our church. Because the only way you knew about it, somebody told you, and they'd greet you at the stairs up front, and they'd walk you downstairs into this basement area. And it's like, I mean, it was everything you didn't want your church to be. There was no signage. There was nothing. There was no children's ministry. The other mistake we made early on, we didn't put high value in children's ministry. We just said, you know what, children, families would come, we said, no, we don't have anything for your kids. They sit in the service with us. We did nursery, but that was it. And I watched more families just walk away because my mindset at that point was, listen, we're doing good just to be here. And we undervalued how important the children's ministry is. And today I feel like, you know, with all the resources, we've really gotten that right. There's so many good resources out there. So
I think for us, we did a great job outreaching. We launched large, but we didn't have a good assimilation system. And you have systems in the church, and you've got to have a good assimilation system to assimilate, build relationship with those new people who are coming in. So we kind of had to do it on the run, and I think lost people because we didn't have that. But over time, we've developed it. And we talk a lot about there's a lot of different systems. Children's ministry is system, discipleship. But for us, the assimilation was one that was a big thing. How about you, Mark? Brett?
I think one of our biggest mistakes that we have made and continue to make is that we're always looking towards what's next, and we're not very good at celebrating what God has just done. Our staff is a small staff, and we're a pretty fast-paced staff. That's how you know you fit, if you can kind of keep up with us, because we're always moving on to the next thing. What's next? And have you talked to this person? And have we hired that person? And have we paid this person? And who's searching for what? And so, but I mean, that's a great thing because we get a lot accomplished in a very short amount of time. And we have people who are extremely gifted in that. But what we're so bad at is not only celebrating what God has just done, we just had a baptism where we baptized more people on one day than we have in our history. We baptized 58 people in one day, and we never came back and shared one of those stories with our own church. I mean, that's just stupidity. We never came back and shared any of those stories with our volunteers, with our givers. I mean, that is the reason the volunteer is staying for three services watching screaming toddlers is not because of how much we pay them. It's because of the kind of impact that they're making in our church. That's what we tell them, but then we never go ahead and put those wind in their sails.
It's because obedience is its own reward. You shouldn't have to do it. The one mistake that we made at the very beginning is defining ourselves too much according to what we were not, as opposed to what we are. We are not a traditional church. We are not a boring church. We're not the way that's being articulated in a popular way today. And fellows that have been on my staff are doing it. Vince Antonucci, I think, is one of the first guys, a good friend. But it's we are the church for people who don't like church. Defining yourself according to that. I think what was happening when I was in my 20s when we started New Life, and your 20s and 30s are spent personally developing, you're individualizing yourself. Who am I as opposed to who I was in my family? I'm individualizing myself from my family of origin. And if people aren't self-aware, then they're doing that with the church as well. Who am I as opposed to my church of origin, and you can end up defining yourself, and the product of that is you develop a rebellious church. You're appealing to a whole bunch of people who want to build a church but according to what they're not, and it's really hard to build unity with rebellious spirit. And I have found some of these churches that our church planters have started on that spirit. They have a heart. They'll get to 500, and then they'll go back down to 400. They'll get to 500 because people are always unhappy. Because why did you attract them? You attracted them because they were unhappy.
You went after them.
You know, yeah. So.
You got what you went after, huh? So we want to open it up to you. We want to hear from you questions, and we'll just kind of try and answer them up here or say we don't know or whatever. But, okay, go ahead. There's some great plans now we developed a plan. One guy who's really put a lot of effort into this is Nelson Searcy, and he has an assimilation system, you know, email within 24 hours, you know, a letter going out within 48 hours, Starbucks card for all first-time guests. But the key is relationship. We developed a team because we had 154. The first service we had was a grand opening. My first church, second church had 383. How do you follow up? You got one guy on staff, maybe a couple volunteers. So we formed a team, a volunteer team that helped do follow-up and actually created a system of you know, first-time guests, fill out the card, second-time guests, third-time guests, letters, emails, all of that kind of thing. Our mistake was my first church, we didn't know what – we just got to launch, and we're so happy we didn't have any plan at all for follow-up. And follow-up's huge, so there's systems there.
On the assimilation system, what we found, you know, there's a lot of great systems out there, like Dave was talking about, but when people come into a church, they're looking for two things. They're looking for relationships. They're looking for responsibilities. And to me, those are the connection points. We try and give them at the Springs on-ramps. You know, we want to give you an on-ramp. So, because some people, they're going to come to your Connect membership class. That's you send them an email, you make a phone call, you try and connect them. Some people, it's small group. They want to get into a small group. Some people, it's a ministry. Hey, do you want to be a greeter? And another mistake we made, one of our core values is every member is a minister. And so we said, in order to serve, you have to be a member. And so you got to go through the class We said, you know what? No, there's some things you don't have to be a member to serve in. You want to be a greeter. You can't be on stage without being a member. And when we removed that barrier, we opened up, and that's an assimilation. You get people serving in ministry. You give them something to do. They're connecting, and that's the whole organic thing of relationships. You know, people connect. But there's some great assimilation systems.
Yeah.
Look at Brett. I don't want to touch that one, huh?
I'll touch it because it's a great question because at the heart of it, you go into ministry because you want to work with people, you want to see lives change, but then you realize you're running a big business as the church grows. And so for me, and I don't know about these guys, but I'll speak for myself, I'm not a great administrator. I'm not a good administrator. I could do it, but that's not my strength nor my passion. It will burn me out. So I'm a visionary, so I had to keep in that visionary role. So Ulta means hiring people who are strong where you're weak, and you complement one another. It's getting an executive pastor. The hard point is, though, you usually can't afford or need an executive pastor till you're running maybe 750, 800 to 1,000. And so it's getting a good administrator in there who can oversee. Sometimes it's just an office manager who's overseeing the secretaries and the other people in the office. But realizing what your gifting is, what your wiring is, and finding somebody who's really good at them.
Well, I think for us, one of the good things out of that was it was a family affair. I had two boys, and my wife and I, and we knew that this season God had called us to this. And when we started the Springs, we pushed all the chips to the center of the table. I mean, we didn't have anybody funded. I didn't know anybody. That's another mistake. We emptied our retirement out, $30,000, and that's how we started the church. But it was, you know, my boys, they were young. They were like 9 and 7 at the time, and I made them cards, business cards, that said Church at the Springs Intern. And I gave them those cards, and they set up chairs with us, and they put out, and they were there early with me, you know. So I think the good part for us, it was a calling that God put on us. It wasn't a job that I had. So I think about the good times of that, because I've got good memories of that. Coming downstairs and setting up the chairs. And Jared, our son, who was 9, he ran, I mean, we had transparencies for the music. Jared's on staff now at 28. He flipped the transparencies. You know, of course, he got jelly donut on it a lot. I think for us, we put a financial system in place. That and you know that we could track and keep, you know, look at trends. But I also do, you know, for me, finances is a felt need today. Yeah. And so you do series that, you know what, everybody's hurting, and you just teach biblical truth, I mean, unashamedly. And that, I don't know where y'all are at, but I know for me, that's always, like, okay, we're about ready to do a capital campaign. I can't stand capital campaigns. I just, you know I got to do it, but it weighs heavy on you. And so, you know, I'm always thinking through, okay, how do we all year teach? How do we, the financial system has to be about what you're teaching too, because the pulpit is the rudder for the church. And, you know, you've got to teach truth. And so, you know, that's how we overcame it.
And one big thing for us is we looked at it from a holistic standpoint is a lot of people are in debt. So it wasn't just giving. We would talk about how to honor God with your money, how to save money, how to get out of debt, and we'd offer them programs on how to do that and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, so it's not just giving. It's a whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in Malachi, it says the only place where God asks us to test him is in this way of giving. And so one of the things that we say is that if you start giving, in particular, we teach the tithe. You don't have to teach the tithe, but we teach the tithe, and we say, if you're not tithing, and if you decide to accept this challenge and you start tithing over a three-month period, if you don't see God bless you within this three-month period and open up the floodgates of heaven, we will return to you every penny that you've ever given us.
You ever had somebody come back?
Nope, not one person.
We did. We had one guy come back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he gave $10. And
I hope he only made $100.
We gave him $100 back. Oh. So, but anyhow.
We keep track of the names.
Okay, so
yeah. 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 Right. Yeah.
Okay. We got what chance for one.
If I can share one more mistake that we made, it would be putting too much trust in, or maybe not discerning well enough, what business principles to apply and how to apply them or how much weight to put on them. One of the most convicting stories that I've heard in the last couple of years was a Chinese minister came to the United States and visited a number of mega churches in the West Coast. I'm sure the East Coast mega churches are much more spiritual. But on the way to the airport, his host minister asked him, what's your biggest observation? What's the biggest thing you learned from these mega churches? He said, it is amazing what these churches can accomplish without God. And the whole concept, the whole idea there is let me say it like this. Scott Peck says mental health is living consistently with reality no matter what the price. The healthy church lives consistently with reality. Good business principles can help us line up with reality, and therefore we get the blessings of lining up with reality. The reality of God, not necessarily the power of God. And so the whole thing about God builds the church. God, the most important thing for us is, God, what is your next step for us? God, what do you want to do here? God, what decision you want us to make at this point? So part of the danger of a session like this is how can we avoid the mistakes so that we don't have to trust in God so much, perhaps? And that would be a big mistake for me, being wanting to be really smart. So as opposed to, God, it's your church. It's going to be really messy. I'm going to be the biggest problem with this church. Just show me what it means to be obedient to you today, and let you build the church your way.
I think part of the presupposition we started with are, you know, mistakes. You learn more from mistakes than you do from your successes. So mistakes aren't all bad. In fact, they can be really good if you learn from them, reflect on them, and grow from them. So we need to stop because our time's up. But if you want others, or you have mistakes to share that we didn't share, we'd love to hear those. Or if you didn't get the ones we shared, all of them, we do have a top 10 here. Just come on up. We'll help you. But God bless you the rest of the day. Take care.